Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled.
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Yeah.
Woohoo!
That's right. It's podcast time, guys. I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. With
Hi.
me. Oh, thanks. With me is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
And JB Thomas.
Hello.
And once again, the Film Bin crew are gathered around to talk about a film and create a podcast with the narrative of us discussing it.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. That'll do. So, this week's film was chosen by Anthony. We all watched it. That film was...
That film was Sightseers from 2012. And it's a film which follows Chris, who is played by Steve Oram, and Tina, who is played by Alice Lowe, as they take their very first caravanning trip together across the British Isles. However, events conspire against the couple, and their holiday starts to take a very, very dark, dark turn.
I would say they conspire against other things in the plot. But yeah, sure.
The film was directed by Ben Wheatley and was written by the two stars of the film, based on some of their own childhood holiday experiences. Yikes. With some additional material from Wheatley's editor, Amy Jump. Sightseers also stars Elaine Davis, Jonathan Aris, Monica Dolan, Richard Glover, Tony Way, and Richard Lumsden.
Yeah, so a lot of British comedy actors or that you don't really know, but you go, oh, it's that guy. That guy's in Game of Thrones. That guy's in The Thick of It. That kind of, you do that all the way through, don't you?
Yes.
So why did you pick this, Anthony?
Because it is a constantly uncomfortable film and is unlike... It captures a tone all the way through, which is very odd, and I don't think I've really seen anywhere before. That, and I'm a big fan of the director, Ben Wheatley. He's done quite a few really good films recently, and some good TV, including Ideal, which I know you like, Rich. A couple of episodes of Doctor Who, which I know you don't like, Rich.
That's right, also.
Plus, it's just... this film, I don't really know how to feel about it. It's like I constantly was laughing at it and yet constantly felt horrible about it.
Yeah, it's kind of like if Natural Born Killers is completely Britishized, a bit more like Hot Fuzz or something, but it's not really one or the other. It's very much a very dark British comedy that you don't really... Like, you almost can't, you can't settle into it because it never becomes a full-on scary horror thriller. But it never... And it keeps being mildly amusing and funny and kind of realistic. Like, lots of the parts that aren't about murder are kind of deliciously realistic and kind of capture British holidaying perfectly. And yet, it's incredibly tense and weird, yeah. It's a weird one. I didn't know what to expect myself. I thought it looked kind of both... It had the potential to be very funny, but also looked like it might be a bit... I don't know, it could have been quite cheap and rubbish as well. I wasn't really sure from this trailer. But I liked this people in it. Like, there's lots of... Like, the ginger-faced man in it is in a lot of British sitcoms. He's in, like... He's in lots of obscure things sometimes, so... You know, he's not that name droppable, but I have enjoyed him in lots of things. Like, there was a Sue Perkins sitcom where she plays a vet, and it's like something like Heading Out or something, I think it's called. And he was good in that. He was another vet. He's in Drunken Histories. He's one of the actors in one of the like that TV show. But they're usually obscure things he's in, as well as the woman who's in a bunch of stuff as well. I'm trying to think what I saw her in. Hot Fuzz, I think she's in.
Yeah, she was in Black Books too briefly.
Yeah. Anyone else? Anyone? Where were these? Where have you seen these guys anywhere?
Well, Tony Way is in everything.
He's in a lot of Liam Herring
British
stuff.
Every British comedy that's been made since about 96 that isn't something awful like My Family.
Yeah, he's in Game of Thrones, which is now like known by everyone on Earth. Some people might not have seen it, but come on, get with the times, guys. Everyone watches Game of Thrones. Yeah, Jamie?
No.
when it's all done, you'll have to catch up.
When it's finished and there's 500 seasons
yeah.
and a box set that takes up my entire living room, I will watch it.
Good idea. Yeah, there's a lot of that, guys, is the thing. From British TV and film. But Jamie, what were you expecting when Anthony put it to us?
I had already seen Kill List.
Yeah.
One of Ben Wheatley's other films, which is not a comedy, very much not a comedy. And I could tell from the trailer that it was very much Ben Wheatley does comedy. And it turned out to be exactly as dark and funny in a deeply uncomfortable way. Like, I was expecting to watch the film and laugh, but also feel a bit sick all the way through.
Sure.
Like, I couldn't quite sit still because it was like, this is horrible. And it alternated between, this is horrible because of the murders, and also, this is horrible because of all the awkward little British conversations that were happening between characters, where everyone was just like, yeah, mate, yeah, right, yeah.
It was just very much like real life, but if
with
real
murder.
Life had funny serial killers bumping people off. Yeah, it was just like almost like the same sort of humour as stuff like The Office, but then, well, someone just died in the last scene, so I don't know how we're meant to sit here and just laugh at the Britishness of it.
I like the confrontation of the practicalities of serial killing, because it's not something that a lot of films do. Like the fact that he's like wiping the guy's head innards off the side of his caravan after he's run him over.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of like scrubbing the remains and saying, good as new. Like, or when later on in the film, when she runs over a jogger on the side of the road and he comes out with like the bottle of like spray cleaner and a rag.
Yeah. It really has fun with the juxtaposition of serial killers being normal British caravanners. That's the key, really, is what if after every kill you do normal campsite stuff and make awkward conversations with your neighbours or, you know, go to a pencil museum or something.
Yeah, and it's all highlighted by the kind of the realism and, like, mundaneness of what's actually happening otherwise from, like, the murdering.
It's what if Bonnie and Clyde was really lame and British?
Yeah.
Go on, Jamie, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, yeah, other than the actual serial killer aspect, the entire plot is just their kind of difficult and faltering relationship as they go caravanning.
It's kind of like two lonely people's rom-com with, you know, it could almost take out the fact that two people are bumping people off. And if you remove that, there's just a kind of touching relationship movie between two people who are in their 30s and probably weren't very popular and have slightly depressing lives. And have found each other and like each other. They have really touching moments throughout, whether it's like howling under a bridge for fun or, I don't know, like they go on little boring walks together that they seem to enjoy. Yeah. And I thought it was rather sweet, actually, at times, if you could forget the fact that people keep dying in it.
Yes, but then that's kind of, these people are so horrible that you don't really know how to feel about them going through it.
But it builds to it. It doesn't just go, these guys are crazy and are going to kill people. It kind of starts with, let's show, it's Chris and what's the name of the woman?
And Tina.
So they show that Tina has lived with her mother probably all her life. She's in her 30s. And her mother is a bit mean, but also needs help around the house. But there's obviously a sense of, you've got a messed up relationship with your mum that isn't terrible, but is obviously you haven't got a pleasant mother, and so we feel sort of sorry for her and get an understanding of her. And then Chris comes and is taking her on a caravan holiday, and he's a relatively new boyfriend of hers that the mother doesn't like, and it's just setting up a nice sort of realistic, difficult relationship that, you know, two people are trying to go on holiday and have a nice time, but they've got the mother figure there. And, you know, it's an interesting start, I thought.
Yeah, I'd like to reference the very start of the film, the opening credits, where a journey is being plotted out on a map, You can just hear someone moaning or wailing in the background, and you're never quite sure what it is until it's revealed to be her mother just kind of moaning to herself, and then a really awkward bit where she's just kind of saying "Mum." Mum, constantly. It's like it just kind of throws you in at the awkward deep end straight away.
Yeah.
I thought the relationship with her and her mum was also uncomfortably realistic. Like, I've known people who have a parent like that and a relationship with them like that.
Yeah, and it's her mum's at that age where, well, she could have some of her faculties could be going, or she could be playing them up. Like, there's a sense that she might be playing it up. Like, she fakes, I think, I can't tell if she fakes falling.
Yeah,
she
sort
of lies on the ground at the bottom of the stairs, phones her daughter to get her to come back. But then when she doesn't answer, she just gets up and carries on. And it's like, did you have to lie there to pretend?
Well, that's the thing. Like, the film is so, dark that it throws you sometimes. Because when that shot first comes up, I thought, oh, no, she fell. She's really hurt. And then, yeah, there's no answer. She just gets up and goes about her day.
So there's obviously a sense that her mother has been playing up her frailties to keep her daughter with her in the house. And we don't really get a full understanding of their relationship, but we know that it's not right. And that could be the reason why, as it goes on, Tina becomes more willing to deal with the things that happen.
A strong sense that she's never allowed her daughter to grow up because she's 34, lives with her mum. Her mum still brushes her hair and she doesn't like her going on holiday and having a boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah. And there's a sense of, it put me in mind of Psycho, the Hitchcock film, and you just think, oh, maybe that was what before the mother had died in that. Maybe she was like that to Norman, whatever his name was.
Norman Bates.
Bates, yeah. And you just, it's very relatable because there are these, especially in my grandmother's generation, there would just be these mean old ladies.
Yeah.
She was nice, but she'd know other ones who were clearly manipulative, but also they're manipulating by playing up how much help they need and how deaf they are or something. And it's like, oh, that's horrible. But so, we don't die. They're not obviously nut jobs straight away. I think Chris is the one who kind of the ball starts rolling with him because he, while they're going on the journey, gets a bit narked on. I think they're in a tram museum on a tram ride.
Yeah,
and someone's littering. Actually, the guy you mentioned earlier was
Tony Way.
Tony Way is a careless litterer, and he doesn't listen and is very rude to Chris when Chris tries to bring him up on it. And then after, I think they're in a cafe or something, and the opportunity arrives. No, they just after they have a Chris is ranting in the cafe, isn't he?
Yeah,
and getting more cross with him.
Furious he was about the slight bit of litter on the tram.
Yeah, and it kind of gives us a sense of his motivations because it's implied later in the film that he has been made redundant and that he's been killing before the film.
Yeah, I like that it never quite goes into it. You don't know whether he's done this a lot or whether he's just started. Why he was made redundant.
The film is, even though it's fairly kind of simple, I suppose, and is more comedy, it always is raising all of these questions. If we step back a little bit just before they're leaving, with their mum. She says she has a general mistrust of him. Mm. And at first you're kind of wondering, she's just being kind of petty and just being the kind of selfish mum that she is being. But then as things go on, it's like, does she actually kind of recognise something off in him, really?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't think they clarify that she knew anything because she's quite a nasty person herself. You can't say if she knew or was just being paranoid, but she's subsequently proven right. And I think there are nuances to the story, and there's an ambiguity and a nice, you can wonder about the backstory of these people a little bit, as you get to know them.
And I then, like the
go on.
I was going to say, I like all the foreshadowing as well. Like when there's the whole subplot about how her mum's dog died because she was like, she threw something to distract it and it jumped to catch it and impaled itself on one of her knitting needles, which was so just disgustingly funny just because it was just horrible.
It was both horrible and ridiculous, yeah.
And then there's this idea that she resents her because she like killed her dog.
That she seemingly is very attached to because it was her only friend and she draws it a lot.
And then as they're driving away to go off on the caravan holiday, there's that bit where she says murderer into the car. Mm. And there's a little split second where you're not quite sure because she's already told Chris she doesn't like him.
Yeah,
and then it's pretty much immediately after that that she says murderer,
yeah.
And it clarifies that she's referring to Tina, but there's that little hint that you don't know whether she's like accusing Chris as if she knows something, and then I like that later on, like Tina becomes a murderer even more so than Chris because Chris kind of does it like it's almost like he gets so angry that he just loses it and just kills people.
At least he has a kind of. A somewhat rational reason for doing it, as opposed to her, she doesn't.
She just comes unhinged just kills people.
No, I think there is. I think they have slightly different MOs. He seems to get narked by usually quite petty things that annoy him. But then he has an hypocrisy as well, because a lot of the time he's an obnoxious person, and he seems things that are bad about other people are very similar to the faults he has. But he gets narked about things like littering and just the way people behave how they shouldn't, and it's just like he selfishly decides to kill people who annoy him in some way. And I think hers is usually jealousy, and they both kind of have a jealousy reason to kill people at times. Where the other one is affectionate is seen as being affectionate with someone or liking someone, and then whether it's Tina or Chris, they don't like that and they end up bumping off someone.
That's true, and it is kind of like it raises questions about like relationships when they're starting out. It's kind of do you do things to please the other person more than just being yourself? If you know what I mean.
Like, are you suggesting that maybe Tina, when she realises Chris has murdered someone at least once, decides that she's going to roll with it and try and please them by joining him? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. She kind of gets a taste for it then. Like, she starts doing it kind of unbidden, and he tells her, like, you can't, it's fine when I do it. When I do it, it's cute. It's not okay when you do it.
Like, Chris has planned a route where he can go on a caravan holiday with his new girlfriend, and can potentially murder people.
Well, I think it's that he likes everything to be organized.
Yeah.
And when someone comes along and litters or like interferes, he gets like he flips and kills them.
Yeah.
And then when she starts murdering people, that also goes against his well thought out caravanning holiday plan.
Yeah.
So that just makes him even more furious because now things are going even less according to his plan.
But there's also an hypocrisy for him all the way through because he is willing to go off their planned, you know, holiday destination, and he almost makes a friend at one point, and he decides to spend more time with his friend, and it's like we'll get to that because it's a bit later in the film, and he goes off and he stops their plan happening, and it's like, well, you don't like going off the plan, yet you're willing to break that rule, and I'm not allowed to. It's kind of a weird hypocrisy.
It's kind of like a classic abusive relationship with like a boyfriend who is kind of a petty child who just wants their own way. Because he does when things don't go his way, he goes off and sulks.
Yeah,
he goes and sits quietly. Like that moment at one point in the film where he goes off and he sits on like playground equipment and won't talk to Tina.
Yeah,
because he's a child. He's a big baby, except that he murders people when he has a tantrum.
And then obviously Tina, having lived with her mum and been in her 30s and perhaps hasn't matured as much as she should, and then they've got this ability, you know, to be murderous and to kind of not shrug it off, because sometimes they actually, like, because this is the thing, they're not just psychopaths who kill. The first one is this: we all should dislike the guy because he's illiterate and he's horrible and obnoxious. But and we want him to pay, but we wouldn't run him over with a caravan. And Chris backs up the caravan, and it does seem like it's potentially an accident. And then the first hint we get is when he's hugging Tina and trying to console her for seeing this guy who's bleeding under the caravan. He has a like wry smile on his face to say, "Oh, he did maybe mean this."
Yeah.
And then, like, what's the because that, then they go to the police station, they kind of report everything as if it was an accident, and carry on with their trip, don't they?
The writer, the travel writer.
That's right, this is the next one.
And, like, I like that those two, that couple, the travel writer and his wife, and their caravan and their dog, are so horrible. Just to, like, they're so unlikable. When Tina tries to give their little dog a crisp, and the wife, in under the pretense of protecting the dog, like grabs the dog's face and wrestles the crisp out of its mouth, just to do something really reprehensible, so that when he does smash Ian's head in with a rock on top of a cliff.
It's interesting. You think he was not vindicated, but had. He had reason to dislike them because
it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't make it quite so horrible. Like it. It's where the comedy comes from because it already gives you a really dislikable couple.
You think it's creating an escapism for people because we all get narked by people in real life, and we'd love to bash the head in with a rock, but of course we wouldn't come even close to that if we're moderately well adjusted.
It does an interesting thing with it, though, because it offers that escapism, but then goes on to show you that Tina and Chris are both horrendously broken, sad people.
But I still think the fact that you think that couple are obnoxious, they are obnoxious that have the dog, but...
They don't deserve death.
No, what I was going to say is, Chris is the first, like, he races them to get the better space in the caravan site, and he's completely obnoxiously cuts them off, and then he is kind of imposes because he comes over, he starts talking to them. They might know who he is, you might know it's the jerk who took their place, and then he's like very like, oh, can I have a look in your caravan, and he's kind of rude to them and kind of forces himself into their caravan and has a look, and then Tina just kind of comes along. And yes, they are kind of a bit sensitive about her feeding a crisp to the dog, but they are being obnoxious. And then when they get challenged, he starts, like, he like pettily breaks a plate and treats them badly. So I still think that couple is very, you know, but like, you know, they're very much victims to these horrible characters we're following. Do you not think?
No, yeah, I do. I think that was a really, like, it's such a, again, like, this film is so British. Like, that situation of someone coming up to, like, your caravan and then, like, making small talk and then saying something like, do you mind if I have a look inside? And you don't, like, you can't say no. Yeah. You just kind of go, okay. Like,
That has come up a lot, doesn't it?
There's so many of those little situations that it's just agonisingly British.
Yeah. Anthony, what were you... What were you thinking about the second, like the couple we meet and then the second murder and things? What's your take on that bit of the plot?
Well, the actors are very good at being that kind of the middle class obnoxious. So they do a really good job. I'll give them that. But I don't know, it's just this is kind of like kind of when the questions are starting about like, you kind of realise that no one in this film is a likeable or necessarily relatable character.
Right.
And it just kind of makes an interesting kind of thing about how you can make a good, entertaining movie and none of the characters are likeable or necessarily relatable at all.
Yeah, there's no real protagonist here.
Yeah. And it kind of starts off as... Chris is kind of like, I suppose, the main antagonist. Mm. And I suppose the obvious plot line that it could be going down is the corruption of Lentina. But, like, weirdly, she starts becoming then worse than him, and
yeah,
she kind of takes over the antagonist role.
Yeah, she seems a lot more, like, potentially psychotic than he does.
Mm.
Yeah. So his jealousy of people, and he gets irritated into wanting to kill someone, and he kills this guy, where he gets the opportunity to kill him because he's going on a smug morning walk to write his third book, and Chris says he's writing a book, and he's clearly not, and is jealous. And so he stoves his head in and, you know, tries to make it look like he fell off, you know, a bit of rock or something, doesn't he?
A crag.
Yeah, also, there's the weird kind of pagan thing that's going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's like a near, like, because part of it is a very well-observed caravanning holiday. Like, I think the writers and stars, I think I read somewhere that they did go on a caravanning holiday as research, hopefully not murdering people. So they very much nailed how you can have irritating neighbours up all night, banging drums, lighting fires, and being obnoxiously hippie. And
all the background characters and all the supporting characters are very, very well observed. Like, a bit later on, Martin, the guy with the bike pod thing.
I have
met several Martins.
Yeah. And even the fact that, like, the guy who comes around the caravan site collecting the money has, like, a second bum bag around his neck. And you just go, that's exactly like all people from caravan parks.
I have to say, the film is just the attention to kitsch detail throughout the whole thing, and just the horrible cheap things is just wonderful.
The knickknacks they pick up from the various British museums and things.
It's later on, but it relates to my favourite visual gag of the film.
Yeah,
where she asks about the giant pencil.
Oh yeah.
And then it cuts to her writing him like a Dear John letter with a giant pencil.
I love the fact that it's an in-joke to British audiences that part of our tourist industry is, you know, a pencil museum. Like, the most mundane thing. And it's legitimately a thing.
Yeah.
And they really are, like, going to be able to buy giant pencils. And I have been to some of these little tiny rural museums that are just, you just sit there listening to the same DVD playing on a wall.
Yeah.
And they tell you about how a miner once almost did a thing. And it taps into that world perfectly. One of the weird things, actually, is I think it was quite nice as they on their murderous caravan trip, they pick up these knickknacks from gift shops, I presume, and they have these little hairy plushy, they're like gonks, I think is the word. They're like little gonks and or like toys or whatever. But what's weird is the first one is from, I think the owner is the first guy they murder. They keep his little knick-knack he's bought in the shop and they put it on the dashboard or in their caravan or something. But these little hairy blue things, Abby and Ollie, our other podcast friends and colleagues, they have a gonk, a hairy, cuddly toy thing, and they call it Klomp von Klomp. And it's got a really evil-looking moustache and evil eyebrows and a little red nose. And there's a whole backstory to this character, this thing they have in their house, this hairy blue thing. And they have these similar, like, slightly more modern, slightly cuter versions of this weird doll thing. And Abby and Ollie, have this story that Klomp is a sort of evil, weird, powerful thing. And I think it's interesting they collect these hairy things and they're on a killing spree.
Gives it an extra dimension for you.
It just weirded me out that they collected these things. So, I like that they bought Kitsch. Aside from my link to it, or whatever, it was nice that they still had a really mundane British rainy holiday.
They never, even with all the people that they kill, they never go like off a deep end and become inhuman. There's still a couple of shuffling, awkward, reasonably normal people just with severe problems.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. Like, the stuff about a couple of times when they kill someone, you then see the difficult aftermath where they have to kind of clean up and make small talk with each other as if it's just taking the bins out.
Yeah, it's like, you know, commit a murder and then have a really bland-looking spaghetti in a washing up bowl with a ladle, which is such a camping thing, isn't it? Like, everyone has had that meal. So they bump off the one guy. who Chris is jealous of, and then there's a bit of a while then. They spend some time having a little montage of holiday and enjoyment in these banal places. I think Tina twigs that he's killed on purpose.
She's looking through Ian's camera that Chris has stolen.
Yeah.
Thinks it's Chris's camera, and then he finds risque pictures of them both.
Yeah, that they took, and we established that they did something. There was that weird scene where they're making love of a fashion, and she's got her face very close to some potpourri.
Yeah.
I really found that funny, I don't know why.
But
it becomes clear that the camera belongs to...
Yeah, and that
recently lost a member. They stole their dog as well. That's one of the key parts of the plot. Does anyone want to elaborate on the dog element of it?
The murder of Ian, all the murders in the film, that's the other thing as well, is they're so gruesome. There's no pulling punches at all when someone is killed in this. Like, it is full on.
It's not kind of like off-screen kind of hinted at. It's proper like smack to the temple, blood and gore everywhere kind of thing.
There's that really eerie scene where Chris murders Ian and he like smashes him in the side of the head with a rock, and you see like, you know, the blood spurt and everything, and Season of the Witch is playing on the soundtrack, and you see like, is that the point where Tina, is she dancing? No, she's having a nightmare at that point, but it's leading on from the guys dancing at the yurt. And it's all this, it's kind of like almost nightmarish. Mm. And then it cuts to this little moment of the dog running away and Chris awkwardly trying to run down the cliff to chase it and not fall over.
It's this man who doesn't look that intimidating because he's in like a red sort of anorak hiking coat and has to really leg it after a dog. And I think it's interesting they put the fact is the dog looks like the dog that has died in Tina's life. And part of before Tina knows that, you know, Chris is a murderer, she is still of the notion of, this dog belongs to that horrible woman. We should steal the dog because it looks like my old dog. And there's that kind of, right, we're going to... And Chris isn't really up for having the dog, but puts up with it because, you know, he wants to keep Tina loyal to him, I suppose. And then most of the time then, they're with Banjo / Poppy the dog, which is, she sort of calls it Poppy because that was the name of her dog. And everyone's like, and then Chris and a lot of people are like, well, it's called Banjo, isn't it? Which, is kind of interesting.
That's her first act of, like, doing something really awful or, like, almost psychotic or at least sociopathic where, like, he's been murdering people, but her first step is, let's steal this woman's dog. She's horrible.
Yeah.
Which is something that you, like, outside the context of this film with murdering people, if you're going to go for, like, an everyday thing, stealing someone's dog is pretty horrible.
Yeah, but it's something you could buy into. I think I've known people who would happily keep a stray cat, even if they know it might be a neighbour from three doors down.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, well, they don't feed him enough, so we can keep him. It's like, no, you can't. You know, I've had moments where I've had to convince people that they can't keep a stray cat. It has to go, and it'll go back to its house. It doesn't actually want to stay here. Like, I've had conversations with, I think, with if I wasn't there... You definitely would keep this cat, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So it's more plausible that this would happen. But then, like you say, she becomes crazier as we go on. Where should we pick up from, guys?
I think the turning point is the next murder of the guy who gives Tina a row for the dog mess.
Interesting quandary. Have Anthony, have you ever been in a situation, you're a dog owner, have you ever been in a situation where you've been berated, or do you always clean up after your dog, or never go anywhere with the dog so it can get up into it? Like, what are your dog scenarios? Have you been in this situation before?
I can't say that I have, but...
I have murdered someone.
You know, dogs pooing everywhere is not very nice to see. You kind of agree with the guy,
but then you're also on where. So
yeah, but you're also on their side then, because it's kind of like, well, it is a bit petty because it is in the middle of nowhere, and
it's the fact that he doesn't give up. Like, he keeps
just
he bullies her about it. Like, he's really not you know, and threatening to report them to the National Trust.
Yeah.
And it's just, I have to say, like, and it just, I suppose at this point, it's kind of more clear of the actress, kind of Alice Lowe's kind of acting style of how kind of schizophrenic and all over the place she can be as kind of like an actress. And I don't know, I think she just does a really good job of, like, this is one of the scenes where she kind of is so emotionally distraught and yet can come back and become a kind of malevolently cruel as well.
It's odd because she has to be vulnerable and scared, and then when Chris comes back to see what the confrontation is about, she finds a confidence from him. And there's that kind of strange thing where Chris sort of starts, often his thing is to start implying that the situation was worse, or that somehow the person who's doing them a wrong has done things that are far more ridiculous and worse, like some really horrible things have gone on. And he accuses them of that, and then it's up to her whether she initially she's like, no, that didn't happen, but then gives him the excuse to have a reason to assault this guy. And it's very interesting how they play the dynamic of the couple, because they're not quite in sync with each other. They're not both nuts in the same way, have the same motives. It's very much a relationship they're developing as a couple, and kind of, you know, it's very odd. And like you say, some tremendous acting from both of them, really. They both kind of play unhinged very well. So, you know, Chris really goes to work on this guy with a big stick, and then leaves him after suggesting he's been... I think he suggests the guy was trying to sexually assault her. He leaves him bloody and on the floor with his trousers down behind a rock or something to sort of throw off the police or some kind of poignant insult to this guy. And then after that, Tina knows that he's witnessed the murders then, and she has to make a moral decision. Is she going to run away? Is she scared? Is she going to be a victim herself? Or does she want to try and help him? And she kind of just continues the trip with him and kind of puts up with it.
Yeah, she just quietly does nothing and goes, oh, well, all right, I guess.
Yeah. I guess because the implication is that this is actually one of the nicer trips in her life. Yeah. She doesn't want to ruin a nice relationship she's had for the first time just over something small like a murderer.
But also, she is kind of stuck with him, too.
But she never becomes... Like, if this were... maybe the story of a one-man serial killer, she'd be going along with him, perhaps, to get away and to go and get somewhere safe. She's not ever the victim. She's never in danger from Chris, you know?
She never quite comes... Like, it does seem that way at times. Like, this guy's kind of scary and, like, unhinged and, you know, how's she going to get away? But at the same time, she never plays it like that. She is kind of like a wallflower, but it's more because of her mum than because of him. And like once she takes an active part in that murder of the Daily Mail reader, that's when it starts to turn and she starts to get kind of into it at that point.
Yeah.
And again, I have to talk about how brutal that guy's death was. The unflinching showing of his caved-in face. This sounds awful, but I laughed just because it was so grotesque and I wasn't expecting it.
Well, a lot of the things in Hot Fuzz, which is sort of tangentially linked with the actors being in it, and, you know, I think, you know,
it was produced by Edgar Wright as well, isn't it?
That's what I was going to say. So there's elements that are very like Hot Fuzz, where it's kind of Britishness, but surprising you with kind of comedy, moments of gore and things. But I don't think it overdoes it, because a lot of the deaths are clubbing or being shoved off a cliff. And they don't like have. It's not like Saw or anything. It doesn't go really weird.
Yeah, it's the fact that it comes in the middle of that mundanity. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's not. There's no close up on the guy's caved in face. There's just like a panning shot that lets you see the whole thing, and then it goes up to them, and it just catches you off guard. You're just like, oh, that's horrible.
So they continue on their sightseeing of various little British places that they can caravan or maybe take in the boring sights, maybe go see a big rock in a field or something. They go to have a meal together, don't they, somewhere, yeah. in, like, a very bland-looking restaurant.
Well, just before that is when they meet their tag-along character, Martin.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With his little bike and his pod on the back that he's working on, which is just, again, it's such a British thing to have this guy who's cycling through the countryside in this little, like, buggy bed thing that he's built himself, that he's designing.
Yeah. And it's what does Tina say? It's like a something coffin.
It's like an alien's coffin.
It is. It is like a strange bug-like pod that he has in the back of his bike that's just enough space to sleep in, but it's so small that you're only and going to be a loser if you spend a night in it.
And there's that great moment after they, like, because they're on their way to their night out at the restaurant and they leave him. So, and then it just shows him try and, like, get in to, like, settle in for the night or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it just starts to roll slightly down the cliff. And he's just, like, sticking his leg out to try and bring it to a halt. Yeah. Which is nice foreshadowing for what happens later.
Yeah, it is nice how they kind of play up this feckless rubbish characters. Like,
I loved, again, it was a nice bit of realism that I don't remember seeing in anything before. When him and Chris are, like, exercising.
Yeah.
And they're, like, doing different, like, calisthenics and cardio. And then it just cuts to Martin throwing up in a bush because he overdid it.
Yeah. It is ridiculous. And that's part of where Tina's, like, psychotic nature comes in, is Chris has befriended a like-minded guy. Yeah. He seems to reference he's worked in plastics before. It could be a lie, yeah. But he seems to be like, oh, this is a nice project. We can be friends and maybe do work together over this. I like your car. Because he's a caravan enthusiast. It makes sense he likes this mini caravan guy. And so that creates a jealousy with Tina. And I think the first time she goes completely mad and kills someone is to do with a restaurant row, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a hen party, which is one of the most, I actually think the scariest part of the film is what, that big group parties? Of women dressed in pink shouting across the table.
Certainly the most obnoxious bit.
And Tina goes off to the toilet, and when she comes back, the hen is has her tongue in Chris's mouth.
As a sort of, as if it was like a dare from the other...
Yeah, it was. They were counting down or whatever.
Bet you can't kiss the horrible ginger beardy man.
Ginger guy, yeah.
While his girlfriend is just in the toilet. Yeah. I mean, she doesn't deserve to die, but that is a horrible, victimizing thing to do. And
There's a nice kind of... There's the turn from Tina then when she commands him like a dog to stay in his seat.
Yeah.
She shouts at him, sit, stay.
And then she goes and follows this, the bride-to-be out and compliments her on her veil. And then tosses her unceremoniously off a cliff. So, you know, that's when it says, okay, she's crossed the line. These are natural-born killers now.
Yeah.
And they're going to be, you know, killing anyone who slights them, you know, as they go on their trip. Yeah, what do you think's best next? Well, what's the next real significant part? Because part of it is Tina and Chris have rows a lot, and it's usually a sort of childish, petty nature. And obviously, they've got to deal with the fact that they both know they're killers, and they almost two separate serial killers who get on each other's nerves for not like responding to what they've done as the right thing.
This is like she's almost starting to kind of leave him behind at this point because he's getting frustrated that she's going like off the map, especially when he wakes up and she's driving the caravan.
Yeah, that's right. They get upset. She's upset because I think they have like a moment where she's trying to use the fact that she's killed someone or the fact that they've killed another person as a turn on. And he's like, no, I don't like it. And he wants to go to sleep. It's and like, then she's really annoyed and decides to basically drive off with the caravan with him sleeping.
She's getting something else out of the murders than he is. Like to him, it's frustration. Whereas to her, it's like, it's freedom. Like, it seems that, like, killing people has given a new, like, kick to life. Whereas to him, it's just, it's something he does that is just an annoyance and gets in the way. And that's pretty much what he says to her. Like, you're out of control. And he says, you're sacked.
You're sacked. Anthony, how did you read Tina and Chris's relationship? How did you take it that he didn't like that she was joining in? Or did you, you know, what did you interpret from their behaviour together?
Well, it's such a complicated relationship, and a movie in general. It's I don't think there is any real answers, and that's kind of why I like this film. It like takes you to places and makes you kind of and shows you things you're not really going to see anywhere else.
They kind of shamble along in a very human way, without any completely clear motivation.
Yeah, and like I said, they're not relatable as characters, but every now and again you get that little nugget from each of them of like, I empathize with that, and you're just kind of given enough to keep you going and kind of give you that kind of uncomfortable feeling of recognition.
Yeah, sometimes. Well, yeah, because with you know, if murder's out of the equation, you know, most people have been in relationships where they've had a row and got back together and made up and have had moments where you're angry with each other but you get over it. And then we've all had, you know, experiences of, I don't know, I'm not saying we've all been caravanning or camping, but we've all been on British trips, whether it's with our parents or later in life, where you can relate to the depressingness of the inside of a caravan or the moments where you're stuck in the rain and you've got nowhere to go and you're annoyed with someone but you're still with them. And, you know, there's all kinds of British holidays wrapped up in this thriller, you know?
That was one of the parts that I really liked is after that, when they're up in the, like, right up in the mountains, and it starts, and they're just sitting outside in silence with a teapot between the two of them, or a kettle, like a stovetop kettle.
And then they have to, then it just rains and they have to go in and, you know, there's just moments of just, I like the bits where they enjoy themselves as well. Like, they go to parks. Like, I've many a times, as grown adults, end up in a park going on the tiny slide, slowly, awkwardly going down it, climbing on the things that are far too small.
Yeah.
And just being, you know, bored and ridiculous. Anyway, Tina starts to turn a corner in becoming a psychopath, and she drives off with the caravan with him sleeping in it. And he wants her to pull over, and then to kind of show that she's a maniac and that she's not going to go along with him just being a mental on his own, she, like, pulls in, but, like, just does it, just pulls into a jogger and kills him with no reason, just because he's there and to be petty and to prove a point.
I think that's really what Chris says, isn't it? Like, he berates her for the fact that that jogger was, like, nobody. They had no idea who he was.
He hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, she killed him for just no reason. And Chris is kind of like, that's not the point. Like, that's not why I've done it.
Also, I think he doesn't like that she's doing what he does. It's like he's in control of his life, and he does these things because he wants to. And if she's just doing them, that's like stealing his thunder a little bit.
Well, he's prone to jealousy, isn't he? Because that's why he killed Ian, because he's writing a book, and Ian's written two and on his third. It's just like, well, if I kill him, he won't write the third one. Like, it's that kind of petty jealousy that he has.
And then the comedy of the film, because it is a comedy, not just a horrible thriller, is the fact that they kill this guy and they argue while mopping up the accident on the road, chucking him in a bush, making sure he's not seen, going about their trip still, and just being this arguing couple while murdering. And that's kind of the joke that is through it from that point on, then, really. I'm not hearing any bad things to say so far. We're just kind of enjoying recapping the bits we like.
This film is certainly not for everyone.
No, I would not recommend it to very many people, but the people I would recommend it to, I would do so very strongly.
If you have a dark sense of humour and an acute awareness of Britishness, like, you have to understand what it's like to go on a caravan-style holiday around Britain, then everything will just be... it'll be like nostalgia for the times where you went, and then also tension and disturbing scenes and comedy. It's a really weird mix for people who can take the concept, I suppose.
speaking of the jealousy thing, it relates to the only death, the only murder in the film that I think is like actually fun, because the rest of them are kind of like funny in a way that you would like laugh nervously because it's so brutal.
Yeah.
But Tina's murder of Martin is just funny because he's in his little pod. Like, he turns up at their caravan, and like him and Chris are planning their like marketing strategy because he's roped Chris into this pod patent idea, and Chris is all for it. So Tina gets jealous and then takes the opportunity once Martin is, he said he's going to go and turn in, so he's gone out to his little bicycle pod to sleep. Yeah. And yeah, she goes out and just pushes it off a cliff.
It's and almost, it's, yeah, to solve the argument they were having.
Yeah.
She murders him.
It's the way there's the long shot of the cliff as this stupid little plastic pod just kind of topples down really like really quickly and awkwardly, just bounces off rocks and then just collapses at the bottom.
I think just that whole scene is one of my favorites, just because it's just the kind of culmination of all the kind of awkwardness.
I feel so bad for Martin when she's like forcing herself on him and he's just sitting quietly in the corner like what?
And the weird thing is just like Martin is only essentially just one step away from Chris.
He's like a less malicious version, isn't he?
It's Chris without the murder streak.
Yeah.
So and you start to enjoy their kind of like bromance that starts going on as well.
Yeah. There's almost like moments where they become geeks who are well adjusted and could maybe there's redemption, even though he's probably going to get caught for these murders eventually.
Martin is potentially Chris's savior, and Tina just kills him.
But you get the feeling that at some point, you know, Martin would say or do the wrong thing and if Martin got any success above Chris would just, you know, kill him with a spanner, and then it would be over. So, but I think what's interesting with that scene that you like, Anthony, is Tina is jealous because, I mean, A, she likes the dog, and Martin has been looking after the dog for them to have a bit of alone time, and for her to put on her knitted lingerie and them to have romance stuff.
And her knitted crotchless lingerie.
Quite. And so she doesn't particularly like Martin because she's jealous that Chris is friends with him as well. And there's an element of she's becoming like Chris now. She's jealous of people and hates them and wants them dead. And he turns up because he has to give the dog Banjo/Poppy back. And then because he's just being friendly, he's with them. And she does have him trapped in the little tiny caravan dining room space. And when Chris goes away, she starts to, you know, flirt, not flirt, but force herself upon him in a subtle way and make the situation awkward, almost as if she wants to, like, she's not doing it because she wants to be with him, but I think because
part of it is revenge for the hen party incident as well.
You reckon?
I think so.
I saw it as, well, she wants him to do something and then give Chris an excuse to kill him so that they'll be rid of him, I think. But it's tremendously uncomfortable.
It would be a thrill as well.
I think I laughed the hardest at her little speech about
what he said.
Yeah.
Just all this, it gets quite disgusting and dark. And
unfortunately, we can't repeat it, but it is
funny.
Yeah.
It's funny and it's bizarre how graphic it is. And what I like is Chris is like, no, I don't believe you. Like, he kind of, he knows that it's a lie that they tell each other when people have done stuff wrong. And so he's not going to buy it when it's his friend is, this man clearly hasn't said these things. He just looks like he hasn't. And obviously it would be out of character for him to have done any of the things she said. And I mean, and obviously the hypocrisy comes in again because that's what she was being, a slightly less version of what she claimed this guy was doing to her. And then Chris isn't really having it. And then luckily, this guy manages to get out. But I think the mistake he makes is to go back and sleep in his pod. Kind of, you can probably just cycle away and leave this.
Yeah.
You've obviously made this woman hate you. You would not stay. None of us would be getting back in our pod, right, guys? We wouldn't have a pod. So
no. Yes. There. Well, yes.
So he stays there stupidly and gets bumped off. And is that... That's the kind of the last proper murder, isn't it?
Yeah, because then you have this, like, they've kind of, without saying it, have kind of entered into a suicide pact. Like, she says that it would be romantic for them to both die together, because she doesn't want to go back to normal life.
Yeah.
And then she finds the drawing of the bridge that he wants to take her to, and he's drawn it, and he's drawn the two of them on top of it holding hands.
Yeah.
And I think there's this kind of unspoken thing that then comes to when they find the bridge, that this is the end of their journey, and like it's clear what both of them want to do, because they've got nothing. Like they must know that they can't go back to society, because people they haven't been subtle about the murders that they've committed.
Yeah. And also, we've got a hint that they've heard the radio reports of suspicious deaths escalating as they go on.
A ginger-faced man and an angry woman.
Yes. And, he could shave and she could shave her head. I don't know. Calm down. Yeah. there's a sense that maybe Chris has been orchestrating it a little bit. He kind of has had what he wanted, which is to have a romantic caravanning trip with Tina and to allow it to be a serial killing spree as well. And that if there's been a killing spree, he kind of knows that the only thing to do is to kill yourself to not face the consequences. And that it would be kind of somehow romantic. Like, what's that film where they drive off a cliff at the end?
Thelma and Louise.
He kind of wants to go Bonnie and Clyde, Thelma and Louise, and kind of die together. And Tina's does seem like that's okay. Like, that is, she's going with the plan. She's aware of it, sort of. And then we go to the last thing on their planned trip, which is the arches of. Well, there's lots of locations I wish I could remember, because, you know, if you want to have a really boring trip around Britain. Yeah. Actually, those places are now extra good because they're part of this film. You could tour this film and see all the locations. So they go to this high up bridge thing and are going to jump off together. And then the final, I guess not a twist, but the final reveal is that they are about to hold hands and jump off. And Chris says, "Are you sure?" And she doesn't answer. And he counts down.
And he says, "Have you had a good holiday?" Yes. And she said, "Yes, best holiday I've ever had."
Yeah, they clearly both did have the best holiday they've ever had. But Chris, unfortunately, is the only one to step off the ledge and fall to his death. And we are left with Tina's reaction, which is subtle. Like, how did you guys interpret it? I took it as fairly neutral and blank, and almost like I couldn't, but also what now? Do you know what I mean? How did you guys see her face?
It left me wondering whether or not that was premeditated or whether she wussed out at the end.
Yeah,
which is nice.
It's hard to tell.
I like the ambiguity.
I just liked it as an ending, because, like you said, like from other films about kind of serial killers, the obvious kind of ending is that either they both kind of commit suicide at the end, or they both
get caught
or end up dying in a blaze of glory kind of thing. So, and I think it's just interesting how she is the one to kind of be left at the end, which kind of makes her kind of the worst of the two, if you know what I mean.
That's what I was thinking. I kind of read it as like she's got such a taste for what they've been like. He's just a sad guy who hasn't achieved anything. He's been laid off. He's got nothing going on. He's killing people just because he's petty and jealous. And he knows he's got nothing left after this trip. So he's got this romantic idea that they're both the same and they can go off together. But she's got a taste for it now. Like, in my head, she's going to go off and carry on the killing spree.
Or at least try and get away with it. Because the thing is, he's dead now. She could get away with it by saying that it was him. He could, because he's dead and he can't talk for himself, she could potentially say he was the murderer and he was bringing me along. I was a victim as well. So there's a sense that she could get out of it. There's also a sense that she gets arrested and ends up in women's prison. Or there's a sense that she continues a killing spree. There's all kinds of options for what could happen, but we just don't know.
I like that dark idea that she continues. Like, he's become a weight that's holding her down. So she lets him do it on the pretense that she's going to do it as well. And then she goes off and does her best to carry it on, because now she's got a taste for it. Which is it's probably the darkest way you could read that ending.
Yeah, but like, then, you know, it doesn't imply that she's going to step off in a minute. It's very much, I just didn't. I saw it as she
becomes his victim. Because she's basically murdered him. She's led him to believe that...
He becomes her victim.
Yeah, he becomes her victim. Like, she's led him to believe that she's going to go as well. And then she basically just lets him go and watches him.
Yeah. But then also, he kind of initiated this turn. Like, she hadn't killed anyone other than accidentally killing her dog. And that she didn't really kill her dog. The dog killed itself. Like, in fairness, it... And they let go... Banjo, who they'd kidnapped. That was very relieving that the dog who had been with them a lot of the time had got to just go be free and will happily go live somewhere else. Unless Tina does go find her and then she continues another caravan holiday in a sequel. Sightseers 2, where she goes to see Spain or France or something. Meets a new person.
I didn't think about it before, but yeah, she plants the seed of the idea of them killing themselves.
Do you think so?
Yeah, she's the first one to bring it up. Yeah, so that's to me, that's like she's become a serial killer, and he's like the last victim of the film. Like she talks him into killing himself.
Perhaps,
but there is also
you can read it a million different ways. Yeah, that's just there what is. I like.
There's also the kind of very subtle kind of reading where maybe she's kind of just doing all this just to protect herself.
Yeah,
like she kind of knows that he's a psychopath, and she just has to kind of go along with it.
Yeah, she obviously
even though she's kind of her kind of dim like. Attitude kind of shields her against that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because of the way she acts, you don't really think she's thinking too hard about things, if you know what I mean.
And like she's played up her psychotic side for Chris, and now she wants enough, and she's not going to go because he wasn't like Chris. She is a different kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So she's been like kind of subtly kind of making it to this point where she can kind of dispatch of him.
So you're taking maybe a more you're suggesting a more heroic reading of she puts up with this to get away with it, and Jamie's saying she's full on psycho.
I think he opened up a part of her that was right. Like and then killing him was her last like chain that she had to free, and now she's going to go off on her own killing spree.
Well, I think at least she has the potential to not be arrested, like because Chris is dead. And she can play the victim. If she is has been subtly manipulating Chris or not, she could get away with the murders based on the fact that no one knows who killed who. She just knows the suspicious deaths have happened. And now the person who will be proven to be the murderer, at least in some of the cases, is there. And she can be the victim or she can... You know, we don't know. It's left blank, and it's a very good way to end the film, I think, because ambiguity, a nice, just a subtle twist... Yeah. And we're just left recalling a ridiculous caravanning holiday.
ambiguity is one of the main tenets of this film.
Mm. I sometimes find ambiguity a bit annoying when it's being pretentious. In this case, it's to create depth of characters and motivation. I think.
Yeah.
So, Anthony, I think you've done rather well. I will say that. We haven't had a grumble about it, really. Anyway, so we have to come up with a rating. I don't know. we're going to run low on them eventually because we've done so many obvious ones from different films. But what do you think, Jimmy? Final thoughts and maybe a rating that we can go with.
Final thoughts. It's hard because I thought it was... I thought it was really good, but I wouldn't recommend it to many people because it's so dark and it's so just like bleak and hopeless, and the comedy comes from such an awful place in the human soul. It plumbs the depths, and there's nobody genuinely likable in it, but at the same time, it's so well observed and it's so well thought through that it's really, really entertaining.
Yeah.
But I do think it has its own niche audience.
Yeah.
Which I think is true of most of Ben Wheatley's films. Like, he makes, for a lot of people, even people who like his stuff, he makes very difficult films.
Yeah.
Because they are relentless and they are like uncompromising and they can be really hard to watch. And this, even though it is a comedy of sorts, it's still difficult to watch.
I think what helps is you know it's a comedy and it's not real. Like, if it was a documentary about a serial killer, because often real-life serial killers can be the most normal people in the world, but they keep severed heads in their fridge and chopped up bits in their bedroom and are completely insane and evil. And yet, at the same time, they're mundane, they live boring little lives.
Yeah, I think...
And if it was real, it would be disturbing. But because it's a comedy, you do laugh at the murders, you laugh at the situations, and you laugh at the well-observed British life that it seems to
have created. It's one step away from being a legitimately disturbing horror film.
Yeah. You just have to... you might find it horrible, but really, if you've got a sense of humour that's right for the film...
Yeah.
You will laugh at it, and it is a good comedy, I think.
If you are, of that, I think it's also very British. I don't think it would play especially well.
But then you might enjoy it as a sort of, because it's so foreign. Like, if you don't have a life that's similar or haven't been on the same world in the same world, it'd be like us watching, I don't know, Scandinavians go on holiday or it would just be like observing another weird culture and you'd find it extra interesting because of that.
Yeah, but that's where a lot of the comedy comes from, is that British mundanity.
Mm.
It is a really difficult one. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really interesting, but it's hard to watch. And it is kind of exhausting.
So what is it? What is our rating?
It's I would recommend it in the same way I would recommend a particular spot for a caravan holiday, because you can go somewhere and it's somewhere in the beautiful British countryside and appreciate all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
But at the same time, you do still have to go on a caravan holiday.
Yeah.
You can enjoy it, but you have to kind of grit your teeth and prepare yourself.
That's my thoughts exactly. It's like a caravan holiday in that it's like being on a caravan holiday with your family where it can be enjoyable. You can enjoy going around Britain and the film is very funny and likeable a lot of the time. But there will be tense moments and arguments and there will be times where it's too uncomfortable and you just want it to be over with. And so it's that balance of fun, tension, horror and enjoyment, and it's that weird blend that only a British caravan holiday can provide. In real life they are just a balancing act between tedious and horrible and wonderful and charming and British and quaint. So you learn about obscure things and you enjoy moments, but you also are with people who create a horrible tension and arguments ensue, and it's very much like a real holiday without having murdered anyone in real life. So I would say the same. It is a caravan holiday of a movie. You will enjoy it, but you have to like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What would you say, summing up, Anthony, what would you rate it as? What would you say?
I've been trying to think of... Well, first of all, I'll say, I really like this film. It's... Like films are usually designed to make you feel a certain way, if you know what I mean. Make you feel good, or make you cry, or make you laugh. Mm. And this film just seems intent on just making you really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I've never kind of had that kind of thing from a film before. And it kind of balances. It could have tipped either way, but it kind of balances it really well with the kind of. The kind of tense horror and the dark comedy.
Levity. That's Sandy.
Yes, there's loads of it. And when you are laughing, it's kind of, it's hysterical kind of laughing.
Yeah. I think it's surprisingly relatable. Some of the relationship moments they have where they're not killing, they're actually, I found myself related. There's the elements I've had in my relationship with my girlfriend. I feel like, we've had moments like that on trips in Britain when it's raining, or going out to a like the bit where they go to like where Chris knows of a like a stream and it's dried up and she's just like it's just a ditch. And it's like, well, it was a stream. You know, it's like that kind of sad, pathetic holidays. I can really relate to the moments they have together sometimes as well. Sorry, not hijacking your point.
No, it's fun. It's a similar thing. I have been on camping holidays similar, and in fact, yes, indeed. And you do recognize half of these things. So for a rating, I've been trying to think of like a piece of kitsch that kind of sums it up. Something that is both hilarious but kind of makes you really uncomfortable at the same time. And the only thing I could think of is like a figure of a gollywog.
They are hilarious, and yet they're so uncomfortably racist.
Yeah.
This film does make you uncomfortable, and it is charming and a piece of nostalgia as well, isn't it?
Mm.
That's very good. I like that.
Very good, possibly offensive.
It creates a tension, doesn't it?
You don't know how to feel about it, do you?
you see one in the window of a shop, and you just go, oh, that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be selling those.
Yeah, it is. It's just this wonderful little piece of toy that can't that exists and isn't. I've seen them sold as well. I saw them in like a card shop, and I was like, you can't sell gollywogs at Christmas as if it's just just Black Santas or something. You can't do that. They can't.
And yet, you might be kind of inclined to buy it just because the gumption of it. If you know what I mean.
It's an adorable little trinket that reminds you of how horrible human beings are.
But at the same time, it's just an innocent little man doll that is black in colour. It shouldn't. There's nothing actually wrong with it. It's just there's a connotation, isn't there?
Strong connotation. Yeah. We can't avoid racism somehow in this podcast.
We're not being racist. It's a good analogy. Anyway, it is a piece of kitsch. It is a very unusual piece of kitsch. And some people, you show them a thing you found in the museum that's really weird, and they go, what'd you get that for? And it's like, don't you love how amazingly funny and horrible it is at the same time? And that some people get it, and some people go, that is the best gift you could ever find.
And some people just don't talk to you anymore.
Yeah.
I get that impression with this film, that if I showed it to certain people, they'd never want to speak to me again.
What's wrong with you? What is wrong with you? You can't show me this. And then at the same time, other people like me and Anthony, we will watch it and go, this is awesome. Thank you. But yeah, we can thank Anthony. He showed it to us. It is a gollywog. It is a caravan holiday. I think in some ways it is Klomp, Abby and Ollie's weird, like, gonk. And gonk is just a term I would use for fluffy, cuddly toy that isn't exactly any animal. It's a thing, isn't it? Like a cuddly thing. But their one is quite old, quite evil-looking. And it's that weird blend of charming, lovely and funny, and also disturbing. So it is a weird blend. And good film. Yeah, check it out, basically. It'll be either a challenge or it'll be fun. So, that's the end of the podcast. Time to say goodbye.
Toodaloo.
So we'll jump off the cliff together, except I will stay here and you will die. Ha 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 ha.
No.
Oh, we're all staying on the cliff. It's fine. None of us are jumping. Oh, dear. Splat.